Dr. McElprang received both his master's and doctorate of social work degrees here at the University of Utah, and he's been a full-time college professor for 3 years, having 7.5 years of experience working in the Division of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the UMed Center. Dr. McElprang has been consulting and in private practice for the past 8 years. Our presenter also has an impressive list of books and articles published dealing with topics concerning sexuality following spinal cord injuries and disabilities, as well as articles dealing with the subject of AIDS. Much of the counseling he has done has been marriage counseling with LDS couples, many of whom have had sexual difficulties related to their interpretation of theology. Dr. McElprang describes himself as happily married and struggling alongside his wife with the challenge of raising 4 children. With such a substantial background, our speaker is certainly qualified to address the topic, sexuality and the Mormon family, just procreation or pro-fun too. This is a good way to start our morning, don't you think? Following our speaker, we will hear, we'll turn the remaining time over to Mary Beth Raines, who will offer comments on this subject, this morning's subject. Mary Beth is in private practice as a family therapist in Salt Lake. She's also a member of the Sunstone Foundation National Advisory Board. Mary Beth is a licensed clinical social worker in Salt Lake and full-time private practice working in marriage and family therapy. She is adjunct assistant professor to the Graduate School of Social Work at the University of Utah. She has published articles in both the Sunstone and Dialogue on sexuality and other intimacy issues in relationships. She is the mother of 3 teenage children. So we'll turn the time over to Romel McElprang.
I mentioned it was rather difficult to hear myself being referred to as doctor again. I've been out of school for the last 3 months, and to come back and have somebody hit me with that after just kind of being a father and husband and that is different. One of the major problems I think I am having this morning is that in preparing for this paper, I wanted to prepare everything I could, and the topic is so broad and also so deep that I tried to compact everything down, and now I get here and I wish I had 5 or 6 pages and I could just talk more from just my heart, I guess, rather than the paper. So I hope to do a little bit of both. Let me just start out by talking, relating some experiences I had. Several years ago when I was with the UMed Center, I was asked by an instructor for the BYU Nursing School if I would come and lecture or speak to some of her nursing students, a class of nursing students, on the area of sexuality, with also a specific twist on sexuality and disability, which is an area I've worked in a great deal. Many of these nursing students were preparing to come and do their clinical rotations in nursing at the Division of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, the nursing instructor thought that they ought to be prepared for this experience. They were going to be working with persons with multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injuries, head injuries, strokes, amputations, and a variety of other neurological disabilities. And it's a pretty tough area, pretty hot topic for people who have severe disabilities. So I went there expecting, as in other presentations, to have people interested, to have a lively discussion, conversation, and had about a 2-hour presentation that I was asked to do. To my chagrin, I thought that I must have been boring people to death because I would ask questions throughout of it and people would sit there stone-faced. I would try to generate discussion. And this class, I think there may have been 25 students with maybe one male in it. I couldn't get anybody to say anything. And I thought, you know, this has got to be a monumental occasion to talk about sex for 2 hours and have everyone bored to death. The cognitive dissonance was immense. But what happened after that? Initially was very amusing, but after a while, upon reflection, became just quite disturbing to me. It took me approximately 2 hours to get the few yards from that classroom back to my car. Because what happened is I just happened to be passing by many of these people, and they would stop me and say, you know, I got a question. I just passing in the hall. Let me ask you a question. And so I would talk for 10 minutes, and it would happen again and again and again. And there were people waiting around after that class for literally 2 hours. I think to be able to talk to someone in private who they didn't have a personal relationship with, and especially who didn't have an ecclesiastical kind of a relationship over them, many of these, and all of them in this case were women, the first week that this happened. This happened, I might add, I think 3 subsequent times, and my experience with minor variations was the same each time. In fact, by the third time, I just, rather than telling the office I'll be back in 2 hours, I said, you better mark me out for the afternoon. Many of these questions had to do with very personal issues. Personal, doctrinal, church, cultural issues. And these people were LDS, as one would expect the majority of students to be in undergraduate programs at BYU. Many of the questions regarded the rightness and wrongness of certain activities or the, quote, church stand, end of quote, on certain sexual practices or activities. And I must say initially I was rather amused by this. But upon further reflection, it really hit me, and probably my amusement was somewhat, putting it in gospel terms, an unrighteous smugness. But upon further reflection, it really began to touch my heart and disturb me. I was struck by the uncertainty, the fear, and in some cases the guilt that many of these people were experiencing. I was struck by the struggle of trying to find a goodness of fit between their sexual desires and behaviors and their fears that maybe in the expression of them that they might somehow be getting themselves in trouble. Then my smugness was completely blown out of the water when I recalled my experiences as a graduate student who in a class on human sexuality had the topic to, was given the assignment to do a paper, and I decided to do a paper on Mormonism and sexuality. So what that did was give me the sanction so that I could go and ask anybody I wanted to all the private personal questions that I had, but of course I could do it under the guise of an intellectual endeavor. It was really quite a good experience for me, and it was also very non-threatening because I could play the intellect rather than writing the questions down real quick personally. But since that time, I've counseled scores of people with problems. Being at the University of Utah, many of those people when I was at U were LDS. The context I counseled many of them in were people who had disabilities, and this was especially difficult because when you have major parts of your body that don't work, and you have to start thinking about new and different and interesting ways and to express yourself physically, then the taboos can become even greater, particularly if we've been taught not to talk about those kinds of issues. Often in my counseling, it's been essential to address religious issues that have contributed to sexual problems. And I might add here, I don't think as a population that we as members of the church probably have more difficulties sexually than non-Mormons do. But the one major difference that I see is that when sexual difficulties are present, that frequently they are present and interpreted within a religious context, within a theological context, rather than within a sexual context exclusively. Or the religious piece just takes a major part of it. These experiences have led me to wonder if, regardless of how unintended, whether or not membership in the church can contribute to sexual problems of some of the members of the church. And if so, what can we do to neutralize this? And so this paper, which is really kind of a rambling of my thoughts, will explore the ways to promote healthy sexual attitudes and sexual expression within the context of Mormonism. Let me talk a little bit about church leaders, because I think our church leaders, particularly local leaders, experience a great dilemma in the area of sexuality. Based on the commandments, we learn that sexual activity is to be saved and only for the bonds of marriage. Masturbation or other autoerotic activity our sexual sins, sexual contact outside of the confines of marriage, are grounds for church action that can in fact jeopardize church membership. Members are taught that moral sins of a sexual nature require confession to the Lord and the bishop. Now, this is some of the only sins that require you go to the bishop to talk about those things, or other ecclesiastical leader, for the transgressor to receive full forgiveness. In fact, we're taught that adultery is second only to the shedding of blood in terms of seriousness of sin. Then we look at homosexual activity, and it's considered to be so heinous by many church members that my experience has been that often we don't even differentiate between homosexuality and homosexual activity. And I think there's a major differentiation. And I remember in Spokane seeing an article of an interview in the religious section of our paper, and one of the state presidents there was asked about homosexuality, and he categorically stated, "We have no homosexuals in our church." I thought, oh, is that right? I better go tell some of my friends who happen to be gay and happen to be members of the church. But what it is, you see, for him, there were no homosexuals. Well, we know the consequences of homosexual activity within the context of the church, but sometimes we even have difficulty differentiating the homoerotic preference from the individual who may have that preference, whether he or she desires it or not. Anyhow, due to the serious, and I've got to get going because I'm sidebarring too much, due to the serious nature of sexual sins, church leaders strongly and frequently emphasize to members, especially our youth, the seriousness of these problems. From age 12, youth begin regular worthiness interviews with bishops or other leaders that continue through adolescence and young adulthood. And a component of these interviews is always moral worthiness. Now, I have to add here that I find it interesting within the church that whenever we talk about sins of immorality, that somehow that almost always, in my experience, has had a sexual context. We never refer to immorality in the context of the plethora of other immoral acts that are out there. I consider it rather immoral to cheat your neighbor. But whenever we talk about immorality in a church context, we always talk about sex. I have trouble with that. The other thing is youth are, quote, given the opportunity, end of quote, to confess their sexual sins to church leaders regularly. These interviews are intended to help youth remain chaste or nip immorality in the bud. I have to say, and I probably shouldn't relate this personal experience, I learned as an 11-year-old, I was playing basketball one day with all my 12-year-old friends in my ward. And the basketball court happened to be at the bishop's house, and he was calling one by one the boys in for their interviews. My bishop also decided that these sins, particularly the sexual sins, these young boys had to go confess to their parents as well. I have to say, as an 11-year-old, I learned I wasn't telling the truth to my bishop. If the need happened that I shouldn't. Anyhow, I think the point of that is that sometimes we learn to avoid the consequences of confession by maybe withholding information. An all too common, subtle, but unintended message is that though immorality is wrong, it's especially bad for girls. And that is not only within the church, it's cultural. You know, I don't know of the female gender word for stud. I mean, a guy in the locker room is a stud. But a woman who has sexual prowess is a slut. I mean, they're not parallel words. I think this comes out real clearly that in doing some sexual histories, when I've talked about sexual histories of people I've counseled, and the topic of masturbation comes up, most LDS men kind of assume, yeah, well, you know, most guys maybe had a little experience with it occasionally, but it's no big deal. But for the women who have talked about that with me, it's almost reminiscent as though they're confessing a sin to me. I'm going, you know, if you want to look at the stats, it's probably 90% of girls masturbate during adolescence, and then there's another 5% at least who lie. I think on the positive side, church members are taught that within marriage, sex is a special and wonderful way of sharing with one's mate. The act of procreation, we're taught, is as close to being godlike as women and men can become. Sex is sanctioned within marriage, especially within the context of bringing children into the world. And within this context, church leaders provide unequivocal support. Let me talk about children and sexuality a little bit. And I think it's important for us to note that our sexuality is being affected literally from the time of conception. And at the time of conception, the genetic scripts that we're conceived with start to take over. And within literally weeks, hormones begin to have a play. The androgens and the estrogens have a major effect from the time that fetus is literally a few weeks old. And those effects begin then and are lifelong. So when we look at sexuality, we need to really start looking at sexuality in utero, because that's where the effects certainly begin. When we get into infancy, infant exploration of the genitals is common and it's natural. It's an important way to explore the environment. I wish my two-year-old wouldn't do it so much. She walks around everywhere with her hands down her diaper. But what we're trying to do is maybe teach her that you don't do that as much in church, Becky, as you do in your bedroom. I must say my daughter does have a smile on her face frequently. Anyhow, unfortunately, you know, I think what happens is, unfortunately, a lot of the messages that these little children will get are very negative. I've seen parents slap their children's hands, and the messages of don't touch yourself there. Because, you know, we're afraid that if they do, you know, that maybe that's a sexual sin. I just can't conceive of that for my two-year-old as sinning by exploring herself, by exploring her genitals. Many times parents will react negatively. There's a discomfort, and sometimes it's even punitive. And as children grow older, they're given similar messages. Little boys and girls are taught not to touch themselves. And it's especially difficult, I've got to say, for little girls. When I do sexual counseling, one of the assignments I frequently give women is to take a mirror and to look at themselves. See, males have a legitimate reason to handle their genitals every day. You know, there's an eliminatory function there. But for women, frequently that doesn't happen. I have to relate one story. I was working with a young woman who had paraplegia. And with paraplegia, frequently one needs to drain the bladder by inserting a catheter because there's not volitional control of the bladder. And as the nursing staff prepared this young woman to do that, her mother was asked to attend in case there were problems. She was acutely injured. And as they prepared her to do this, the mother, they cleaned her genital area. Her mother said, "Well, what's that little mound of tissue?" "Well, that's your daughter's clitoris." "That's my daughter's clitoris? You mean the clitoris isn't in the vagina?" She had no idea. Now, this woman was a mother of four children. But her genitals were so taboo to her that she didn't know. Discomfort regarding sexuality is manifest in the numerous names we have for body parts. I can't think of another name for this appendage than arm. I really can't. You know, maybe somebody else could help me. But I can tell you that if we came here, we could come up and list 75 million names for things like penis or breast or vagina or those kinds of things. And our discomfort is very, very manifest in that. I have to tell you one experience. My daughter, my 11-year-old, who was about three at the time, knew the proper genital terms and had a young cousin who she went to spend the night with. And they were naked, I think taking a bath together or something. And anyhow, Rachel knew the term for penis, but came home and decided that after spending the night at her cousin's house that he had a penis hanger. Because she knew the word for penis, he only knew hanger, so she put the two together. I said, "No, Rachel, let's talk again." Okay. I think as adolescence happens, you know, children have new and confusing ideas that are presented to them, or new and confusing experiences. The hormones are rushing through their bodies. Tremendous kinds of things happen. But all too often, they don't get the messages. They don't learn the appropriate terminology. Parents have the responsibility to teach their children what is happening to them. As those hormones start coursing through their bodies, they need to know what's happening to them. And two, to teach the moral ramifications, to teach the moral part of sex. Proper terminology taught in toddlerhood, graduating to frank, detailed, open discussions of sexuality and sex are will reap great benefits. And all too frequently it doesn't happen. Usually because of lack of information on parents' parts and also a lack of discomfort. It seems that many parents who are the most upset about attempts at public education of a sexual nature are also those that have the most difficulty teaching their parents. As one LDS author said, it is the father of lies who introduced sex education into the world. I thought, okay. What happened in the book of Genesis when the Lord, you know, it's interesting, the Lord, well, I'll go into that a little later. But unfortunately what happens is people turn to magazines or turn to older friends or a variety of things to get their information. And how accurate is Playboy or how accurate is the 11-year-old child down the street going to be telling my 8- or 9-year-old about sex? I'm afraid not terribly so. I must say I'm very pleased to have read the 89 General Handbook on Instructions on the subject of sex education when it says, parents have primary responsibility for sex education of their children. Teaching the subject honestly and plainly in the home greatly improves the chance that young people will avoid serious problems. To help parents teach this sensitive and critical information, the church has published a parent's guide. It also says, the last thing it says is when schools have undertaken sex education, it is appropriate for parents to seek to ensure that the instructions given their children are consistent with sound moral and ethical values. So there, we see here not a categorical castigation of schools of doing that, but an acknowledgement at least that schools and other institutions will do that. But what it does also is make clear that sex education is first and foremost our responsibility. I have to add that on more than just occasion, I wrote in my paper on occasion, it's more than just quote on occasion, I run into the situation where parents have taught their children that sex is dirty, undesirable, base, something below them. Most often this happens to women, where the girls are, they're taught as girls that sex is a responsibility or a chore to be engaged in to satisfy their man, and that sex for personal gratification is a totally foreign concept. Frequently this is unwritten. It's not something, or unspoken. But I've got to tell you, the unspoken rules in families are far, far harder to break than those that are spoken. Because you don't know how to deal with them, because they're not out there in front of you. You don't know how to put words to it. But frequently I'll see that, particularly with women. Let me just talk about sex and marriage. You know, marriage kind of seems to be the ultimate experience for Latter-day Saints, at least for many. It's looked forward to with great anticipation, but for the emotional and physical bonding, the physical expressions of love certainly have ecclesiastical and scriptural sanction. In fact, the first command from the Lord to men and women recorded in the book of Genesis dealt with sex and marriage. It said, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." I have to add that it said, "They shall be one flesh." And after that, it didn't say, "And then 9 months later, there will be three of you in the flesh." There was not that mandate. That mandate was not given in that context solely for the use of creating children, or it would have said it there. So the Lord must have very early sanctioned the appropriate use of sexual expression. There's little doubt that the Lord not only approves but condones. In the modern church, the purpose of sex, sexual relationships most often espoused is for procreation. And also we see something about the spiritual bonds talked about. However, I must say that in terms of discussion of the physical enjoyment, that references to that are few and far between as it pertains to spouses. Far more common are references to sex in marriage as appropriate if, quote, kept restrained, end of quote, and within normal limits. For example, Elder Kimball, when he wrote The Miracle of Forgiveness, said in chapter 5, The Sin Next to Murder, he devoted 15 pages to sexual impurity and then added that the line that condoned sex, that condoned, quote, a controlled and normal sex life, end of quote. There was no elaboration as to what constituted controlled sex. Does that mean I don't groan or something? Joseph S. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make. Joseph S. Smith stated that sexual union is lawful in wedlock, and if participated in with right intent, is honorable and sanctifying. President Kimball in Faith Precedes a Miracle stated that pure sex life in marriage is approved. Again, sexual expression is confirmed here as appropriate. In the same section of the book, he refers to sex outside of marriage by stating, "The doctrine that the devil is so eager to establish that sex relations are justified on the grounds that it is a pleasurable experience in itself and is beyond moral consideration is unacceptable. While few Latter-day Saints, I think, would disagree that sex should not be engaged in without moral consideration, I think where we have conflict is over the statement that it's as far as it's not okay as a pleasurable experience in and of itself. I think we would buy the moral consideration. Where we have difficulties is the pleasurable experience in and of itself part of it. Church leaders really say little or nothing about sex within marriage for the purpose of physical and emotional pleasure, satisfaction, and bonding. I have to add that in fact, many messages, whether covert or overt or otherwise. I went to Bruce McConkie's Mormon Doctrine, and in his section on sex desires, it contained absolutely no information, and it referred the reader to quote, see sex immorality, end of quote. Now, obviously, the message to me here is that the reader is that physical sexual contact are somehow sinful or immoral. It says sex desires, see sex immorality. The primary message given to church members is that sex is first and foremost for procreation. Elder David O. McKay in 1919 said, in most cases, the desire not to have children has its birth in vanity. Such feelings often tend to put the marriage relationship on a level with the panderer and the courtesan. Rodney Turner takes this sentiment to the extreme by stating, apart from parenthood, marriage has no eternal validity. End of quote. He also emphasizes that marriage does not justify, quote, unrestrained sexual activity, end of quote, and states that a couple's love for each other and desire for sexual intimacy are inversely related. So the more I desire my spouse sexually, the less I love her. A whole lot of people out there that must hate each other an awful lot. He states that the strongest sexual desires between spouses occur when, quote, love is least present, end of quote. Doggone it. And here I thought I loved my wife. Okay, anyhow, with messages such as these, it's no wonder that many LDS couples are confused or eschew the wonderful bonding and sharing that can come from a mutually satisfying sexual relationship, physical sexual relationship. I'll skip over some things because I've sidebarred too much and I'm getting short on time. Let me just state that I think overall that we've seen a softening in an attitude that the primary messages that we have had, in fact, have been that sex is for procreation. And for some, and to some extent, we see intimations of the spiritual gratification. And I could go through three pages of quotes that talk about things, but let me at least talk about birth control for a minute. This is a statement. Let me just read a statement from the First Presidency, 1969. It says, we seriously regret that there should exist a sentiment or feeling among members of the church to curtail the birth of children. Where husband and wife enjoy health and vigor, it is contrary to the teachings of the church to curtail or prevent the birth of children. However, the mother's health and strength should be conserved. It is our further feeling, and I like this, that married couples should seek inspiration. I think too often we forget about that last part, that married couples should in fact seek inspiration, that it really needs to be a choice there. On the other hand, there's no doubt about the sentiments of the church. I must say that these statements, and I'll read another statement a little later, have become more tempered. I've gone over a few prior statements that don't talk about seeking inspiration or anything like that. They are very strong. I have to comment here. This is another quote from Women in the Priesthood by Turner. And it has real implications to me because of the blaming of women and the place it puts women. It says, both husband and wife must exercise self-control to avoid using some form of contraception other than that provided by the menstrual cycle. This may appear unfair to those women who are subject to irregular menstrual cycles. However, The admitted inequities of nature's method of birth control are presumably to be borne along with the rest of life's inequities until a better day comes. In all likelihood, now this is where the problems really come. In all likelihood, menstrual irregularities came about through the violation of God's laws of health and hygiene. If so, the sins of the mothers of past ages have been visited on their daughters living today. But again, are we to free ourselves from the natural consequences of the race's past sin by resorting to new sins, the sin of contraception? I read this, and if I hadn't needed it for my talk, the book would not have made it. The book would have made it into my circular file. This type of a sentiment is so condemning of women. It blames women. It is so demeaning to women. And I would say, how dare somebody make a statement that blames women who have menstrual irregularities or other, quote, female problems somehow on their sins or prior sins. You know, it's kind of like if we have, you know, males sometimes have infertility problems. Maybe it's because my progenitors or somebody else's progenitors. I never hear male sexual problems referred to as because of some kind of sin that I engaged in. But it's real easy to be glib and do that. It not only has personal implications, but certainly the political, the structural implications are major in this area. According to Turner, women are to be blamed for gynecological problems. And the physical punishment the Lord might impose on her. Because of the wife's menstrual irregularities, sexual contact was limited, and when they, quote, couldn't help it, end of quote, and had sexual intercourse using contraceptives, there was tremendous guilt that followed. I don't get upset about this, so. Due to the fact that they felt comfortable sexually only when pregnant or trying to become so, the marriage and family relationships of this couple were seriously damaged. Another couple I worked with came in after the husband announced to his pregnant wife that since the goal of sexual relationships had been met, that they would not be engaging in sexual relationships until the termination of pregnancy. The completion of pregnancy, I guess. The General Handbook of Instructions, March 1989, I think is somewhat more liberal. It says, husbands should be considered their wives who have a great responsibility, not only for bearing children, but also for caring for them through childhood. Husbands should help their wives conserve their health and strength. Married couples should seek inspiration from the Lord in meeting their marital challenges and rearing their children according to the teachings of the gospel. This statement is certainly markedly different even from the 1969 statement. It also contains the subtle but important statement. I didn't read one from 83, but it removed a statement from the 83 General Handbook instructions which said married couples should exercise self-control in all their relationships. Unfortunately, this statement is not available for distribution, and this is difficult again because of a culture. You know, this seems to be the most opening up sexually that we've seen from the church leaders, but you know, we all need to be able to see that so that more people can get permission. Not all of us, because some of us, it's no problem, but many people need to receive it to see that because of, to help open them up. I got to add, a couple of things that have happened that show that there is some attention paid to it. In 82, President Kimball was quoted in the book Spencer W. Kimball. He said, if you study divorces as we have in these past years, you will find sex is the first reason. They did not get along sexually. They may not say that in court. They may not even tell that to their attorneys, but that is the reason. Now, that's a pretty heavy statement, and that comes as a result of some research that the general authorities are having to start to look at and say, whoa, here's something that's important. I think the September 86 issue of the Ensign, Brent Barlow, spoke of the joy and intimacy in marriage. And a good deal of that was even quoted in the 89 Relief Society manual and used as part of a lesson. Unfortunately, that was about the only lesson that dealt with it, and the priesthood manuals for the last few years haven't dealt with it at all. In fact, I have to add that a few weeks ago, they used the scripture that I quoted, in fact, about a man and woman becoming one, but it was in the context of men kind of teaching their wives and children how to be good people and all those kinds of things. And I raised my hand in priesthood and says, this become one flesh, that has a little bit different meaning to me. It fell upon deaf ears. No one was willing to discuss it, and certainly the priesthood manual was not willing to discuss it. So I said, okay, it can mean something different to me, and you can have it mean teaching and training. Let me just say, I go over some sexual problems, and one of the things I've done in counseling is frequently when people bring sexual problems into me, they will frequently frame them within a context of the church, and the first thing I do is take it out of the context of the church. I tell them, you have a sexual problem, and I will talk to them about the church stand on sexual matters, and let them know that I don't think they have a gospel problem, they have a sexual problem. One of the And it's a little smug, but you know, but I think it's an important little thing. One of the things I'll frequently talk about or use for people who have some of the overall guilt and say, you know, that sex shouldn't be enjoyed is I will ask them, and this is usually, women who have the problem. And again, I think it's, we can talk about that whole socialization thing, but I ask women, I say, can you tell me why God created a clitoris? Well, I don't know. You know, the clitoris is the only structure that is there exclusively and only for sexual pleasure. It has absolutely no other function. And I'll say to those people, why would a loving God create a structure that is there for your pleasure and then tell you that it would be dirty or unholy for that to be something that you could enjoy? Not focusing on that structure as being something major, but really think about it. Why would God do that kind of paradoxical thing to people to create something so pleasurable when it's supposed to be dirty? That's not the loving God that I know. The Father and Mother in Heaven that I know would never do that. Let me just also talk briefly about what's right and what's wrong. This is one of the questions I frequently get. I'll close this real quick. I'm sorry. People, you know, what's right and what's wrong? And one of the things that frequently come up is the topic of oral sex. And, you know, one thing I ask, well, you know, what is oral sex? Is oral sex kissing? Is it a mouth on a breast or on a neck or those kinds of things? You know, what is oral sex? About 10 years ago, and I think it was February of 81, the church leaders came out with a statement, in fact, relating to what was okay and what wasn't okay in sex, in marriage. And there was some frowning in the area of oral sex, but it also said, church leaders, don't delve into the intimate matters of your members' sex lives. Well, geez, within a week, stake presidents were getting up in state conference and preaching against the evils of oral sex. Bishops and stake presidents were asking their members about intimate matters of their sex lives. Let me just give you this quote, which is, again, from the 89 Handbook of Instructions. I have a nice bishop who let me look at that. He wouldn't let me copy it, but I sat in his office and wrote it down so I could put it in the paper. He said, this is on temple recommend interviews, and I think this is the statement that I give my clients that I see. When interviewing an applicant for a recommend, do not inquire into personal intimate matters about marital relationships between a husband and wife. Generally, do not deviate from the recommend interview questions. If during an interview an applicant asks about the propriety of specific conduct, do not pursue the matter. Merely suggest that if an applicant has enough anxiety about the propriety of conduct to ask about it, the best course would be to discontinue it. If you are sensitive and wise, you can usually prevent those being interviewed from asking such explicit questions. Well, frankly, that's the best one I've seen. What it's telling them, and what I tell folks I work with is, hey, in determining what's okay, you and your partner talk amongst yourselves and then go to the Lord if you've got questions. But a bishop or state president or branch president does not only doesn't have the right, but it's absolutely wrong for that person to delve in the intimate matters of your sex life. That's something that you and your spouse and the Lord need to deal with, and not an ecclesiastical leader. I might add that 81 statement, about 10 months later, there was another statement that came out that really kind of seemed to retract that. I wish I had time to go in and quote some of those things, but I don't. Let me just talk quickly about heterosocial relationships. I think that's so important. We have, on one hand, we seem to have an atmosphere in the church that we're somewhat repressed sexually. On the other hand, what I have found in my experience, and this is especially difficult, I, as a social worker, I work in a profession that is predominantly female. Most of my faculty colleagues are female. And I have wonderful relationships with them, to go in and talk and to share and to intellectually be stimulated. And I notice I said intellectually. And to have those relationships are wonderful. I think we have a culture within the church, and I don't think it's doctrine. We have a culture within the church that it seems that once we marry, that we can't have opposite gender friends. I don't think my mother's here, so I'll relate this story. A few years ago, she had a situation where she was going up to Temple Square every week for some kind of church calling. And there was a man in the ward who was doing the same thing. Now, they live out by Little Cottonwood Canyon. And every week, they would both get in their separate cars. They lived two or three houses from each other, and they would drive up separately. And I said, well, Mother, why don't you just drive with this man? Well, it was inappropriate within an LDS context to drive to and from Temple Square together. Because we've all heard of the Bishop and Relief Society president stories. Well, they weren't Bishop and Relief Society president, but if it can happen to a Bishop and Relief Society president, it can happen to anyone else. Now, those things do happen. But I would suggest to you that what we need to work on in this church is a desexualizing of things. For men, if we can desexualize our relationships with women to whom we are not married, and frankly, to women who we are married, it's not the whole thing, but by desexualizing, it allows us to view people of the opposite gender as co-equals. But what we do is we sexualize it so much that we're afraid that any kind of intimacy outside of the bonds of marriage, particularly after we've been married, will lead to something sexual. And when we create a culture that it leads to something sexual, I would submit to you that it's more likely to happen. If we expect it, it's more likely to happen. I was asked by my bishop recently to see a woman in my ward, and I sat in the bishop's office for 2 hours counseling this woman who had just a number of horrible problems that she was facing. What was fascinating, she didn't drive. She lived about 3 blocks from me, and so I said to my bishop, it was a drive of about 5 miles home, well, I'll just take her home. And the bishop about came unglued, you can't drive her home. And I said, Bishop, the woman wasn't there. I said, Bishop, I promise you nothing's going to happen in a 5-minute drive from the church to the home. But it was this, and it just struck me crazy that I could spend an hour and a half to 2 hours in an office, but what would people think, or what might happen in the car? I mean, I drive in the front seat of my car anyhow. Well, I would just say this, that in terms of this, I look forward to the day when I can feel it to be within the culture of my church that I love very dearly, that I can have female friends in my ward and in my stake and wherever I meet them who are members of the church, that I can have close, co-equal relationships with, so that I can experience that part of the gospel that I think I miss out on. And that women can have the opportunity to experience that, those relationships with men other than their spouses, that co-equal relationship rather than that just hierarchical relationship. That is something that I look forward to in the church and hope dearly to see. I won't go over my conclusions here because I've taken too long now, but let me just say that I think sexuality is a wonderful part. It's a part of what we are. It's a major part of who we are. That though I don't think LDS people as a body have more sexual problems, I would submit to you within the context of the gospel and the eternal knowledge of our heavenly parents that sexuality, problems of sexuality should be far less present than they are in the general population. The fact that I don't think they're any more present doesn't make me feel good. Because with the knowledge that we have of the eternal nature of a physical, loving, caring relationship between my heavenly parents, that I hope I can emulate. And I have to say that I think they probably enjoy it. You know, that it's pro fun too. That it's my hope that we can in fact create more of a culture in the church that sex is more than just procreation, but it really is pro fun too. Thank you.
I must say that I really enjoyed Dr. McElprang's paper, and since I also have limited time, would like to focus just on two areas in reaction to it. One is in strong support of sexual education in the church, and I think that the strongest place for sexual education in the church is needed for adults. That obviously, as we know, to teach a child something, we have to teach the adult first. And so teaching adults about sexuality is important, and I would like to further emphasize that in addition to teaching about the plumbing, that is where one's clitoris is or what's one actual words are for penis or vagina, that the nature of sexuality itself is one of the major areas where we have serious and significant problems. And let me pull from the body of his text to give you two or three ideas about that. With girls being seen as more responsible than boys, it's important, I think, in the nature of sexuality to know something about the history of sexuality. That idea that girls are more responsible came from, of course, an idea that girls are less interested, and therefore there's a strong difference in the genders, which is largely a Victorian idea that became institutionalized in the church. So something about the history of sexuality through the world, I think, is a part of that sexuality education that we need. Secondly, it's very clearly said now that sex in marriage is to be a special way of sharing. There are, however, many special ways of sharing talked about, and you will have Ensign articles about that all the time, but no references or rare references to sex. So the sexuality education, I think, needs to move more into what one can do to enhance and enrich. And I think specific kinds of techniques are very important. And here's one of my major points, which I wish you would have emphasized somewhat, which is that there is a plethora of sexual information about sexuality, sexual techniques in the world at large. And because they are not written by church members, and because some of the values advocated are not the same as ours, or as those in the church, does not mean that they are not readily available and much to our instruction. I would guess, in fact, that 90% of the information all of us have here in this room is not about sexuality, is not from the church, but is information at large, starting maybe in a locker room as slumber parties, but hopefully graduating to education texts and in magazines that we may read or hear about, movies and so on. So that I wish that we would also increase our own sex education and advocate that in the church to in a way that fits within the church's wishes to go find information elsewhere in the world, which is essentially what is done in every other topic in life that we are asked to find and edify our education. Another area in which we need sexuality education and information was also mentioned in his reference to homosexuality. That not only is there not in the church a good discrimination between gender preference and activity, homosexuality is often equated with hypersexuality. That a person must be consistently and only interested in sex if they're homosexual, and erases the similarities that homosexual people have with heterosexual people of interest in intimacy, of loving, of many other interests in life, and so that there's a black-white category that's set up. And for those people who experience some homosexual impulse, and for those people who also experience being totally or very closely bonded to the same sex but may have sexual impulses heterosexually, that creates a lot of confusion about who am I and am I wrong or bad. Essentially, my point is, most importantly, that our focus in sexuality is on doing, what we do right and what we do wrong. And that, in fact, the basic joy, I believe, and even connection and sexuality is about being. That those times when we experience ourselves most fully sexually, whether in fact it's primarily a sexual experience or whether it's also included with loving or spiritual feelings, is those times when we move from monitoring how we're doing or exactly what we're doing and move into an altered state almost of how we're feeling, how we're being, what we're experiencing, that incredibly intense experience of just moving from moment to moment, experiencing pleasure, experiencing closeness, experiencing connection, and moving almost into that ineffable realm of being alive and being close. In fact, Alan Watts said one of my very favorite things, that he talked about these altered state, ineffable experiences. He said, in fact, if you translate them into the world of doing, you can't do it. It's like trying to F the ineffable. So I strongly agree that the ignorance leads to problems and that we need an equal emphasis on being in our sexuality as in doing it correctly and in understanding more information. I don't know how much the emphasis came through in the talk as it did in the paper, that the change about birth control and some other issues in the church that have become a little more liberal, in his quotes, has occurred because there's just been a change in emphasis, even though there has been no doctrinal reversals. That's from his original text. This is one of my major problems, actually, with changes in the church often, is that the change in emphasis about birth control, for instance, has come subtly over time simply by stating things differently, even in the bishop's handbook. And in that sense, we are not openly told we are changing in emphasis, or this needs to be emphasized differently. And in that sense, our church structure has a lot of similarities to dysfunctional families, which is that it is secret. You are not to know. And if I'm changing my position, you have to pick it up kind of in the subtle messages that I give you, because I will not tell you that directly. Only people don't say that, of course. You have to figure that one out over time. That, oh, this is different. And so I see this obsessive need for us at Sunstone, in Dr. McElprangan's paper, in my own working through sexual issues year after year, is I closely compare this person's general authority statement and this general authority statement and this general authority statement and say, where is everything? It's like a child trying to figure out the congruent and incongruent messages of the parent. And I wish that we were more open about saying, we've changed our minds. one last quick comment. Although I heartily agree that there is a difference between sexual problems and gospel problems, and when he counsels people and says, you have a sexual problem, not a gospel problem, I agree. However, I do not think that it is that easy for people who have grown up in the church, because all problems, every issue is seen through the gospel. Even scientific issues, medicine issues, everything is seen through the gospel. And so that more work needs to be done about differentiating what is a sexual problem and what is a gospel problem. And let me give two examples again from his text, one by the bishop's handbook, which is, if a person is too anxious, just tell them to discontinue it. In my experience as a therapist, a lot of the anxiety comes from past negative experience, and that anxiety many times arises, say, in a sexual relationship, because you're trying to have that anxiety or that previous wounding, whether it's sexual abuse or whatever, healed. That the anxiety comes when we have been wounded into the loving relationship, and so that's not enough. It needs to be clarified what all sexuality is about and how sensitive the natures we carry. The second is, and it's a more direct disagreement with Dr. McElprang, which is that he encourages LDS people to ask directly to the Lord for interpretation about their marital practices. I agree with that, but I believe that given that the gospel is such a global lens for most people, that the way we ask the questions predisposes the answer. So we need more sexuality education so you can ask questions about how you're doing it or whether it's okay or about your being outside of the realm of the gospel or outside of the realm of your usual way of understanding. And that will help us, I think, ask more informed questions and receive more loving, direct answers from the Lord about our very being and nature as sexual people. Thank you.
We want to thank both these speakers. We have 5 minutes remaining, and I feel like there may be some questions that you may want to address. So we'll do that for 5 minutes if you'd like to. If anyone, yes, in the back. Please address which speaker you'd like to. Okay. Okay, Dr. McElprang. Okay.
It's Romel. I don't even let my students call me doctor.
When you're in a temple recommended interview and I ask you on that subject, are you doing anything unusual? I always so whatever it is that they ask.
Yeah.
I always, you know, ask correctly, but I always wonder, well, what do they mean? Do I get asked? So what do they mean?
I guess my response to that, the question is, when they ask in the temple recommend interview, you know, you're doing anything unnatural or weird or unusual, what do they mean? And I always wonder. First, my suggestion to you would be, who cares what they mean? You know, I know we do, but we need to maybe move to a point of saying, am I comfortable with what I'm doing? And frankly, what might be okay to them sexually and what might be okay to you sexually are different. And that's why I say that it needs to be a matter between the spouses and maybe the Lord. I think I have an idea what a whole lot of them mean, but that doesn't mean that I have to buy into that. And to take that one step further, I've had people that I've counseled say, well, geez, my bishop asked me directly about things. And what I have counseled them to do, though I've never had the misfortune to be asked that, would be to say, I'm sorry, bishop, but you have no right to delve into the intimate matters of my sexual life. And if he becomes more specific with that, then to refer him to the handbook saying, Bishop, you are explicitly instructed that you are not to do that. And therefore, I will not answer that question because it's a violation of my personal space or whatever else. Because what I feel comfortable with is okay. And if I feel comfortable, then I can answer that yes, and I don't really care what they think. Yeah, I agree, and I think that it goes back to what Mary Beth said, too, in terms of educating children and adults.
A number of years ago, I thought we probably should develop an assertiveness training course for bishops, temple recommend interviews.
Well, I guess what I would say to you is, in fact, if you look at the fine print that we never get, that is when, in terms of the bishop's interview question, is it possible that they're maybe alluding to child abuse or other things, and the other part of it was, is doesn't a bishop have the right to ask about those questions? I would suggest that if the bishop is going to, if those are issues that we very much need to be concerned about, and I would suggest to you that in those worthiness interviews that we need to address those things explicitly. You know, are you engaged in any kind of abuse, sexual, physical, emotional, or whatever, if we're going to do that? But what happens is, and I think Mary Beth talked about that, is we do it kind of, we allude to things. It's almost like we do it with mirrors. And frankly, if we're going to do it, let's say what we're going to say. Because if we don't, then we have the problem that this woman has. What do they mean? I mean, let's be upfront about it. That's the one problem. The other problem is that without asking about it specifically, people have all sorts of defense mechanisms that they can use to deny that they couldn't if they asked if they were asked more specifically. I'd be happy to talk after.
I know you have many more questions, but that's our time, and we'll have to dismiss. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.